Hello and welcome to this week's Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is...
Joe Manis with the St. Louis Beacon.
Jason Rosenbaum with the St. Louis Beacon.
And a longtime listener, but a first-time guest.
That's right, John Lamping, State Senator.
So, Senator, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I was born and raised here in St. Louis and went to school out east. And
Where out east?
I went to Princeton, and I have a master's degree from NYU, and then stayed in the East Coast for about 10 years working in the financial service area. Met my wife there. I'm married 25 years. In the early 90s, we had three children, and by the mid to late 90s, decided to bring them back to St. Louis to raise them here. The early 2000s, we adopted three more kids, so I've got six children. When I came back to St. Louis, I immediately got involved in lots of community things, and as time went on, I got involved in more and more of those things. And, you know, kind of how I ended up in political office is kind of in the 2008 election cycle, that all went on. And, you know, I went to school with Michelle Obama. She's a classmate of mine. And
law school?
No, undergraduate. She's a Princeton.
Undergraduate,
yeah,
right.
So she and I were at Princeton together. And then my roommate was from Chicago, and that was a network, African-American guy from Chicago. And then two of my
– Do you have any good stories about
Michelle? No, she's pretty boring. And then two of my roommates went to law school with Barack Obama. So with that election cycle, that was my generation. It was very – you know, it was personal. One of my roommates, you know, really worked hard to support President Obama. And I was doing all this community service, and most of it was, you know, at-risk youth and in the city here. And we weren't making a lot of headway. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll volunteer for public policy service. And so I knew enough people in the Republican Party to kind of convene a meeting in the early part of 2009. And I just said, look, I'll volunteer to run for an office. And they had me contemplate a couple of different offices. And ultimately, we came to the determination that I would run for this office. And that's how I ended up in politics. And I was elected. And I just finished my third year of service.
So what's your... I mean, when you look at, okay, you said you're in your third year of service. What do you think of politics, just in general? I mean, now that you're in the middle of it.
Oh, I think there's a lot of reforms that are necessary for it to be a more productive process, a more productive thing. I think that the average person, I'm the average person prior to getting into politics, they just have their head down and they're focusing on their lives, their career, their family, their community, And they're trusting government to go do its thing, and they trust in it to be effective and to be there for the right reasons. And, you know, someone with a business background would come into the General Assembly and say, well, oh, my God, there's so many simple reforms we could make to make this a more productive process. There's a complete lack of understanding of what goes on in Jefferson City in amongst the community of people.
I think that's definitely true.
You know, and it's something, you know, it's media is what media is. There's only a certain amount of space dedicated to state politics. So there's a real challenge to try to get an understanding out to the community. The individual legislators don't really have much of a platform or a podium. In my time in office, we've had 3 years with Governor Nixon, who for the most part has not tried to push policy ideas from his podium. He has got a very big podium. So there's a lot of reforms that could happen. I'm not necessarily optimistic that they will, because you have to kind of reform ourselves. And for the most part, I'd say most of my colleagues are just fine with the way the system is.
Now, you're kind of a rarity in the Missouri Senate. You didn't come from the House. Mm-hmm. I don't think you ever even worked in, you know, the executive branch or somebody else. How does that change your perspective on legislating, just not coming – just this is your first office, and does it make you more willing to do – things that kind of push against the status quo a little bit? Like, how does that kind of affect your legislating mentality?
Well, yeah, I really took the first year to kind of to watch and listen and learn and get an understanding of what can or can't happen. And it's a very – when you win election in November, within 60 days you're in the General Assembly and you don't have a lot of time to kind of distill your thoughts. But ever since then, I've had lots of ideas that I think should go forward. And I'm not optimistic in that this reform can actually happen from within. So you've seen examples of legislation I filed to reduce the time in session, so to go from an 18-week session to a 12-week session, things like that. Combine offices, lieutenant governor's office with the governor's office.
Yeah, go ahead and talk a bit more about that, since this seems to be your big focus right now.
Well, I mean, it has been my focus. Again, I don't know that there's just not a willingness to do it. 18 weeks to 12 weeks is simple. There's there's more than enough time to get done what we need to get done in 12 weeks. You look at states the similar size as ours, Virginia, they go 8 weeks. And Texas is in the news right now, but Texas, they meet every other year for 90 days. And they have special sessions like they're in right now. But nonetheless, there's really no reason why Missouri should be meeting as long as they can. And so a lot that I hear from constituents, and really I think in the press too, is there's all kinds of bills that people will say, this is a crazy bill, this is a crazy conservative bill, crazy liberal bill, and why was it filed and why was it heard? Well, partly because we have a lot of time. There's more than enough time. People will say, the General Assembly ran out of time, this bill didn't pass because it ran out of time. Well, that's just not true. You two guys are veterans down there. Bills don't not pass because it ran out of time.
Right.
And so I think this year I was very pleased by the fact that we worked very hard. So the pace of the Senate was very different. It's my understanding that we spent more hours on the floor of any Senate that Republicans have had the majority for a little bit over 10 years, and we spent more time on the floor this year than ever before. We considered more ideas than ever before. Senator Richards is to be commended for that. I kid him and tease him all the time, but let's get back on the floor, let's get out there. And when I supported Senator Richards in his race for a full leader, and I made specific note of how many times in the first 2 years we would come into session at 4 o'clock on Monday and be out at 5 o'clock on Monday, and how it was a waste of everybody's time. So things like that. I think that the process could easily be refined, but it will require a very large podium by somebody outside the chamber, because there's not a desire to reform itself.
I mean, is the governor even in a position to do that, just playing devil's advocate, since he's a Democrat and the Republicans control both chambers of the General Assembly?
I think a Democratic governor could. I think this Democratic governor can't. He's in his fifth year, and he has consistently not tried to lead on just about anything and not have a legislative agenda. I look at the governor. One of the things I was surprised the most by is how important that executive branch is to state government. You look at states all around the country. In New Jersey, for example, you've got a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature. Or you look at states that have mixed government. States that are going hard in one direction, California maybe is going hard to the kind of the center left. States going hard to the right. Kansas City is going kind of hard to the center right. They're all being led by governors. They're not being led by the General Assembly. And we have a situation where this governor, he just protects interest. He does not lead. I sat down with Governor Daniels the week before he left office to go become the president of Purdue.
Oh, you're talking about the former governor of Indiana. This is just for our listeners.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I knew this guy. I'd read some of his books. But, that he had a legislative agenda. He was in office 8 years. Every year he had a legislative agenda. The General Assembly, the first 2 years of his time in office, was a mixed government. House was Democratic. Senate was Republican. He gave his acceptance speech his first year, walked off the podium, walked into the Capitol, and he had found sponsors for 70 bills in both the House and the Senate. And each single year he had a legislative agenda, and he committed himself to working with the General Assembly to move Indiana in a direction. That's not what we have in Missouri.
So before we get into specific issues, what were some things that you kind of sponsored or spearheaded this year that you felt were particularly impactful that ended up passing? And if there was something that didn't pass that you'd like to mention?
Or was ignored, which is what he's been talking about.
Yeah. Well, sure. Each of the 3 years, I mentioned before, I have three adopted children, and when I got to the Capitol, I wanted to commit myself to kind of that universe of people, those children, adopted children, foster care children. And so each of the years I've been there, actually been relatively successful, sponsored legislation that addresses the concerns of that community and actually had that legislation be signed into law. So this year, Senate Bill 47 was a bill that it came actually out of St. Louis County, the Adoption and Foster Care Coalition. They have a process where they place hard-to-place foster children, mid-teens kind of children, and there's this thing called a legal guardian that the legal guardianship allows the legal guardian to actually have certain rights with respect to support for a foster child, but it was narrowly defined in the state of Missouri it was essentially a blood relative.
Right.
And so if I were your best friend living next door and you passed away and I wanted to be the legal guardian for your children, then I couldn't be the legal guardian by definition, even though you and I could be best friends. And so we expanded the definition of legal guardianship. The governor actually signed that earlier this week. And so that's really a compelling piece of legislation that in that space that I did put forward and that passed. another bill that was the third or fourth year in a row that we, as the state of Missouri, we offer accommodations to guide dogs if you're blind, but we don't offer them for when they're used as therapy dogs for autistic children or veterans that are dealing with psychological issues. And finally, that bill actually, too, was signed a few weeks ago. The thing this year that there's two things, really, that I would have liked to see come to be and that didn't pass and or didn't make it through to the final finish line in even the General Assembly. In December, when we pre-filed, I actually pre-filed legislation that ended up being part of it ended up being in our tax cut bill. That was the House bill. I don't remember the number. But I actually had provided for transportation funding inside of the tax cut legislation.
Right.
That was the approach I wanted to take. The Senate never took that approach. When the Senate sent its bill to the House actually picked that up, and that's what they sent back to the Senate, was that was where you're raising sales taxes and doing other things and lowering income taxes and other taxes as well. But in the bill that I pre-filed in December, that actually provided $400 million for MoDOT to do that. What the House sent back had about $300 million for MoDOT to fund mm-hmm. their mm-hmm. needs. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that my single biggest disappointment was the fact that that was not the approach that we took to find a solution for transportation funding, as well as have that be part of what was ended up being our tax cut bill.
Now, you came under a lot of fire or pressure on the filibuster that you helped lead on blocking the transportation tax approach mm-hmm. that you proposed, which was the one cent increase in the sales tax. It was supposed to just be for 10 years. I know that the RCGA and some of the others, major business groups, were calling people after the first round of the filibuster and who were pretty upset with you. I'd be interested in your philosophy and why you decided that it was an issue that you needed to really stand up for, and B, what's been the fallout?
Well, sure. Just again for your listeners, so Missouri state tax is 4.225%. So the proposal was to raise it 1%. Missourians pay in about $8 billion of discretionary monies. I mean, that's essentially what we pay in. A lot of the other monies we pay in are dollars that are targeted dollars that are matched by federal programs. Mm-hmm. So we have about $8 billion in revenues. We have a 4% sales tax. And the proposal was to raise it 1%, so almost 25% increase of the state sales tax, as well as this would generate $800 million in new taxes. So it would be increasing our taxes in the state of Missouri by 10%. And what I mentioned earlier, I had in legislation that I filed and the House worked through, we were and people that were pushing for this $800 million in increased taxes, in meetings I had with them, I said, well, I can get you $200 million. We can get you $300 million. We can get you $400 million. They said, well, we don't want that. We want $800 million. We want the largest tax increase in the history of the state. And they were dead set on that. So we voted that bill out of the Senate the Thursday before spring break, so early in March. It had 10 no Republican votes and sent it to the House. And I will be honest with you, I thought we would never see it again. Mm-hmm. That the House holds itself out to be this very conservative bastion, and the legislation that they send to us, things like tort reform and labor union reform, those things get kind of bogged down in the Senate. In the House, they push those things right out. They pass them. I saw the Speaker right. talked about he's going to pass right to work this year in the House. So I was quite certain that
How will that get out of the Senate, though?
But my point is when 10 Republicans voted against this largest tax right. increase in the history of the state, I thought, well, we'll never see this again. There's no way that the House will pass it, or take this up, amend it, and pass it and send right. it back to us. So that's exactly what they did. I think myself as well as the proponents, what I heard behind in the grapevine is 6 weeks out, meaning 6 weeks left to go, that there wasn't even a thought that they would get it out of the House, and they had not lobbied up completely, and then they did just that. They lobbied up and they got it over. And it got there with 3 days to go. And at that point, again, for the benefit of your listeners, 10 Republicans voted no. And I've been there 3 years, and I've never seen a bill that 10 Republicans vote no on that ultimately goes and passes. Mm-hmm. And each one of those 10 Republicans knows that they can vote no and tell everybody, oh, I'm against that. I voted no. But they also know that they could stop the bill too.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, that was what should have been done. I thought the House would have stopped it, never sent it back. But at the end of the day, that's what three or four of us did. And it wasn't even a dramatic filibuster. We only spoke
How long was it?
It's 4 or 5 hours. It was, yeah. it was, uh, but it was,
And it wasn't just you. It was also Rob Schaff of St. Joseph, Ed Emery of Lamar. And did Paul Lavoda get involved near the end?
Well, here's the issue.
He's a Democrat.
He's a Democrat.
There's 10 Republicans that voted no.
Yeah.
So it's when we have seen filibusters in the past, and later on the filibuster occurred on the tax credit bill. The tax credit bill, there's only 5 or 6 Republicans that are against new tax credits. Mm-hmm. But this was a situation where 10 Republicans voted against it. And I actually – I won't name names on the Democrats.
Was it because of the size of the
– Oh, it was everything.
It was everything. Okay.
Well, for example, in the state of Virginia where you've got a Republican governor and you have a Republican General Assembly, they spent 3 years – and I had this – I was on a radio show in Columbia with Senator McKenna, not Ryan, but his father, who was pushing for this tax. And we talked about the pie. And I said, well, look, here's what I want to do. I want to figure out how to reallocate monies inside the state budget today. And again, in the legislation I proposed, it was to move $200 or $300 million over to transportation. And
where was it going to come from?
Well, it was going to be where we're going to raise the sales tax 2/10, 3/10, 4/10, some number that we would settle upon, and we would do it inside of the tax cut bill such that it would be revenue neutral, so it would be Hancock neutral,
okay,
and wouldn't have a vote of the people. We would actually be leading on this issue, not asking the citizens to lead. And that's what they did in Virginia. So Virginia spent 3 years trying to they pulled money out of the pie and they sent it to transportation. At the end of the 3 years, the governor, Republican governor, said, look, we've done all we can. I propose a 6/10 sales tax increase for the next 5 years to finish the job on funding infrastructure. Well, we didn't do the first part of that. We've never done the first part of that. There's been no effort in these last 3 years to reallocate resources in the pie. We went straight for a 10% increase on tax revenues. So if we went through a period this year or the last 2 years or the next year, and there's no doubt we can find $200 or $300 million and send it to MoDOT to start the process. On the radio show in Columbia, Senator McKenna said, well, you know, quarter sales tax increase, that won't get you anything. Well, you know, I beg to differ. Quarter sales tax increase is $200 million. You can bond against it almost 2-to-1. It would allow for a $1 billion project to take place. I think in this example of this 1% sales tax increase, the outside forces, they thought they had the opportunity, and they probably still do think they have the opportunity to get that, you know, $8 billion over 10 years, which, again, the funding ratios are the same. They could bond that cash flow to where they're building a significant number of projects. So that's kind of how the whole transportation thing went down.
Now, you just mentioned there you kind of have a different perspective on tax credits, kind of as an awkward segue to that.
Sure.
Tell me kind of about your perspective. I know that there's been generally a you know, intractable conflict between the House and the Senate, especially on historic preservation and low income.
Which are the two largest tax credit programs? It's just for listeners.
And a lot of people in St. Louis, for example, you know, go crazy whenever you talk about capping the historic preservation.
Which is the largest program in the country, almost by – if we could cut it in half, it would be the second or third largest in the country.
So what's your perspective on this issue?
Let's talk about the negotiations, the attempts the last 3 years to try to come to some resolution. So here's how I would describe that. I think there are a very small group of people in the Senate, not more than 5 or 6, that we look at each year there's as many as $600 million in tax credits that are redeemed and authorized. And there's a very small group in the Senate that think that that's too much money. You know, that again, our budget's $8 billion, so it's not, you know, it's 8%, 7% of our entire budget. And that we think that number should not be $600 million. It should be maybe $400 million or $300 million. Or in some instances, you know, some of us might think it should be zero even, that there's that philosophical we shouldn't be targeting state tax dollars. How good are we at allocating those resources? So there's a very small group that want that $600 million to be less than $600 million. There is an overwhelming majority in the Senate and in the House to maintain all the programs we have and to consistently introduce new programs. So this gets branded. So what's happened is at the beginning of 2011 session, when the big new program was Aerotropolis.
Correct.
Senator Perkerson had filed nothing but reform bill that came from the commission that looked at, you know, reducing the exposure. And then Senator Schmidt carried Aerotropolis bill. And they were pushed together as a way to try to get the two done. I think that's a mistake. I think that we should look at reform by itself, and we should look at new programs by themselves. So there's not a majority of either the House or the Senate that wants to do reform, meaning they want to reduce the liability. The bill that the House passed late in the session and that Senator Schmidt brought to the Senate floor that our leadership wanted us to pass was not tax credit reform. It actually spent more money the first 7 years than it did cut tax credits. So this has been another one of those issues where it's very complex. There's a lot of moving parts. The public back home doesn't have it's hard enough in the building to understand what the heck's going on this issue. But I think that it's kind of irreconcilable in that enough of us in the Senate want that $600 million to be less, and enough people in the Senate and in the House have no problem with that, and they have no problem with it being more.
Why do you think that is? Why does some want it to be more? I mean, I'm just trying to explain it.
Well, if you're a fan of smaller limited government and you actually are successful in that approach to governing and you come back home and people say, well, what'd you do? And you say, well, I decreased the size of government. It's now smaller. It's less intrusive. It's limited. Some people say, well, that's nice. That's great. But if I go home and say, hey, you know what? I sponsored a tax credit bill that's going to create this activity. You're going to go see it, feel it, and touch it. And I've got people that really want that to happen, that live in your community, that make a lot of noise and do their own press releases. Well, that, from elected officials' point of view, that's a pretty good deal. So that sounds good. I did this. People applaud me for it. The press covers the activity. And so there's an inclination and a tendency for elected officials to gravitate towards that approach to legislating, which is to have said that they did something in their time that's tangible.
We talked about pressure on the transportation bill, but was there a lot of pressure from St. Louis development interests, banks, you know, rehabbers to keep everything the same for you?
Well, to keep everything the same, that was exclusively the historic tax credit people.
Okay.
You know, I just would suggest that that's a program that's completely out of control. To think that we could cut it in half and it would still be in the top two or three. When I tell people that we spend more money on historic tax credits than the 13 original states spend on tax credits, that we spend more money on historic tax credits than the state of California spends on tax credits. And I actually think that, you know, their demand for the size of their program really works against lots of other things. Paul McKee worked, you know, he was looking for $7.5 million to help with the land assemblage process of redeveloping the north side. And there never once was a moment where the historic tax credit people who think would benefit mightily by the redevelopment of North St. Louis City, there was never once where they said, well, look, we'll lower our cap $7.5 million to get money to go to the north side. It's a very tight-knit community of people that benefit by that historic tax credit program. And they are loath to have that number come down at all. Same thing for the low-income housing tax credit program.
Now, you mentioned before the show that I guess your biggest priority for the next year or so is going to be ethics reform.
And in some ways, what he did with tax credits kind of fits in with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to just generally, what would you like to see? I know you sponsored a bill that would have
It was brought up briefly, but then nothing happened with it. It was toward the end of the session. Am I correct?
That's correct,
in that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Explain the bill first and kind of explain your ideas.
The only ethics bill that got through committee and got onto the floor this year was to dramatically change the ability of a legislator to become a paid lobbyist. So at one point, the bill was to ban it for life. Later on, to get it out of committee, was to limit it to 10 years. And it got to the floor where you'd be limited to 10 years, with me understanding that that's probably would have to be amended to a smaller number. The reason it spent so very little time on the floor was that, and I sympathize to some degree, the Democrats had filed all kinds of ethics legislation, none of which got heard in committee. And here it was with maybe 8 weeks to go. It was not super late, but here was their first opportunity to stand up and be heard on the bills that they had filed. And I went over to the minority leader. They started talking. I said, look, if you want to get what I propose done, then you need to withdraw these amendments because we're not going to take any of this. This is not going to be the comprehensive ethics bill.
And some of the amendments that they were throwing out were it was banned on like lobbyist gifts and things like that.
Lobbyist gifts. It was campaign contribution. It was
right.
When you use the word ethics reform, it is a very wide, broad spectrum
Correct.
Of ideas.
And I know that you have not taken any lobbyist gifts. You're in that small club. Basically, of people that refuse to take them.
I would say that I'm in the tiniest of clubs in that it's the policy that I had from day one. And when a lobbyist will put in for an expense, which can't happen if you go to some group meeting or, I mean, I had one lobbyist, I met him at Starbucks and he put in an expense for $2.50. I actually write a personal check back to the lobbyist. So there's been some of the legislators have adopted this process of reimbursing the lobbyist
with their
campaign money,
contribution.
Which there's some issue. That's an ethics issue, actually.
Yes.
There's a very small group of us. I think Senator Sifton actually is. That's his approach too.
Yes.
So for 2000 and after watching 2011 and then thinking we should do ethics reform in 2012. We've got a lot of kind of veterans in our caucus, and they have been through these ethics reform wars, and they have no energy for it and no desire to do it. As my first 3 years, I went from maybe 6 or 7 bills to this year, I think I had filed as many as 40 bills. And now my focus for next year, you will not see me file more than 2 or 3 pieces of legislation. And in the off season, and particularly the last 2 years, I've spent a lot of time with my colleagues. We started caucusing. The caucus you see today started caucusing after 2011.
Right.
Yeah, and we really, because we were just somewhat disgruntled, and we thought we needed to begin this process of becoming a team. My entire focus in this offseason is on ethics legislation, and it will be, I'm looking at the entire spectrum. You can expect me to file both a legislative fix as well as a ballot initiative fix. In these conversations, I'm more than likely to end up talking to outside groups that are also contemplating the ballot, and I think that would be the best use of this.
Now, what about campaign contribution limits? Because that typically gets thrown in with this ethics reform umbrella. What's kind of your take on that issue?
Well, philosophically, I think it's free speech, so I'm against campaign contribution limits.
Okay,
so that's the philosophy. But the reality is that there are lots of different feelings about lots of different things. And so I'm going to enter into this entire negotiation with understanding that I might have to negotiate. I'll tell you where I'm centered, though.
Right. That's what I wanted to know.
Where I'm centered on ethics reform is it's on the legislators themselves. So I think we need to hold ourselves to the highest possible standard. We are entrusted by the people. There are things like, for example, restricting the lobbyist, a legislator from becoming a lobbyist. That's very important to me. Things like that. Things that help the legislators hold themselves to the highest standard.
Now, does it hurt, just so our listeners know, that many of those lobbyists are former legislators? I mean, when I go up to the Capitol, a lot of the people who I've known from previous years are out in the hall, so I can run out there and ask them this, that, and the other. Does it make it more difficult because many of these lobbyists are former legislators, and because of term limits, you've got some of your colleagues who may be looking at joining them and maybe making as much or more money as they make now?
Multiples of what they make now.
Okay, I mean, is that one of the problems in trying to get it through?
It's earlier we spoke about reforming itself.
Right.
That will be the challenge. And that's why I will be legislating, I will be trying to do a ballot initiative, and then I will likely coordinate my efforts with or at least understand what other ballot initiative people are thinking.
So I wanted to touch on this very briefly because we are –
he showed me the clock.
We've gotten very freewheeling as always. In 2010, you won a very close race against former St. Louis County Councilwoman Barbara Frazier. I think you won by 100 or 200 votes or something like that.
A little bit over 100 votes, correct.
And there's already a Democrat who has thrown her hat into the ring. I read an article on Creve Coeur Patch that you're thinking of possibly your decision on whether to run again is a little uncertain right now. I wanted to just get kind of what your sense is about next year and whether you run.
It's entirely dependent upon my family. So I'm the father of 6 children. My second youngest child, not shortly after I was elected to office in 2010, she's an accomplished gymnast. Mm-hmm. She's Chinese. She's got a physical advantage in a lot of ways. And she had to move – we had to move her to Blue Springs, Missouri to train. And that's a center that they develop national team gymnasts. So there's 4 girls that train there now on the national team. That began in May of 11, and beginning in the fall of last year, my entire family, none of my family, lives in St. Louis County.
So
I live in St. Louis County, but my work requires me to be here. I'm kind of here Monday through Friday.
Right.
And I go back and forth to Kansas City for the weekend. When we're in session, I go back and forth to Jeff City from Monday to Thursday, and then I go back and forth to Kansas City on the weekends. And so the decision we're going to make as a family, it'll happen in the fall when we know where our family is likely to live in 2014-2015. If I were deciding today, my family would be living in the Kansas City area for the next few years. And that's it. I enjoy what I'm doing. I appreciate the people that I represent. But in my family, we go God, family, and country in that order. And my family is not with me in St. Louis.
Legislating is probably number 20 on that list. That
falls into the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's important, but not as important.
Yeah. Right. So I'm working on the first one. And then my family has always been a huge priority. We came back to St. Louis to raise our family. I have a really extraordinary family. And they have made a tremendous sacrifice and they've come because they've come and gone to St. Louis. We try to stay together as a family as much as we can, I never would have run for state senate ahead if my family was training in Blue Springs, Missouri.
Wow. So did your family support what you're doing in Jeff City?
They support. We've made a commitment, so mm-hmm. they understand that that our family, that Dad made a commitment. He ran for this office, and he has to fulfill his commitment. That's what we teach our children to finish what you start.
Well, I've said this publicly, but if you decide to run for re-election, I think you'll be a formidable candidate just because, 2010 you ran in, I guess, a more Democratic district than
almost
it is
60%
now.
Democratic.
Democratic.
I think it'll be a close race either way. I think it's just a swing district. And, if you don't decide, I'm sure there'll be a Republican free-for-all, and it'll be a fun race to cover.
I don't know. I would disagree with it's not a swing district. It is a Democratic district.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and
I guess I was being more charitable.
No, it's a Democratic district that happens to be held by a Republican. When we look at districts that like this district now is 53 or 54% Democrat.
Okay.
When we look at Republican seats, they're the same number. Those are Republican seats.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to have you back on next year to discuss or make an announcement.
Not
either way.
Next year, like in a couple months.
In a couple months.
Well, that'd be great.
Well, that should just about do it for the show. We have to get out of the studio, I believe. But you can read all of my stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can read all of Joe and Jason's stories at stlbeacon.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. You can follow Jason on Twitter at
Jay Rosenbaum.
You can follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JManNies.
And you can follow the senator
on Twitter at John Lamping.
Well, Senator, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back next week with no guest since it's
the holiday.
Since it's the holiday week,
July 11th. But we do have one on July 11th, Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. Should be a great show.
Compelling podcast.
Very compelling. So, Senator, thank you for joining us. We'll be back. Until then, so long.